I was once in a band that put out one and only one full-length album. Before that, back in the early 2000s, I was playing in a hardcore punk band and I was a little bored. I'd been in punk bands since I was 14, and this band was fun but kind of stale. And my musical taste had always been pretty broad, but in 2002-2003, I was listening to a ton of hip-hop and also a ton of music that I was discovering, a lot of it through tracing back hip-hop samples. But I was kind of catching up on music that I had missed out on, being raised strictly by MTV and alternative rock radio, and then getting into punk. So I was listening to a lot of stuff like James Brown, Parliament Funkadelic, Earth, Wind & Fire, Prince, and especially Sly and the Family Stone. So one day, after an uneventful show at a tiny venue where only a handful of people showed up, I quit my band. The drummer that I had started the band with was pretty upset. The day before I quit the band, he had gotten a tattoo of our band's name. He got it done by our bass player with a homemade tattoo gun, so no matter what, I think it was a bad idea, but I'll admit my timing was not great. I didn't have a backup plan for a band, just an idea in my mind that I wanted to start a band that somehow channeled all this music I was listening to. And then a really good friend of mine who was in another band, a band that I actually looked up to, he told me that his band was breaking up. And his band to me was more like a real band. They'd put out records and toured. And I said very nonchalantly, well, if you want to join my punk funk band that I'm making, there are slots available. And then to my surprise, he said, yeah, that sounds awesome. Let's do that. Now, it's not like this was a revolutionary concept. It was not totally unprecedented for a bunch of punks to start a funk band. Early post-punk bands like Gang of Four were very influenced by dance music. And in the early 2000s, there had been a resurgence of those kind of dance punk bands. You had bands like The Rapture, The Faint, LCD Sound System, Chick Chick Chick, Moving Units. So it felt like we were doing something new and exciting, but we're also kind of part of something upcoming. We found a drummer, a saxophone player, some additional percussionists. We wrote some songs, we recorded a couple on a four-track, and then, like any self-respecting band in 2003 did, we put them on MySpace. And now that seems obvious. You find fans by putting your music on the internet. But back then, it seemed pretty crazy when people we didn't know were liking our music. And after being on MySpace for not that long, a small, very small, independent record label from Florida reached out to us and said they wanted to put out our record. And that to me was a big deal. All the bands I was in before, we had recorded songs on maybe a four-track, and we put them on demo cassettes or maybe a burned CD, but we'd never had a real album. This was going to be a real album with a booklet and cover art and a CD tray. Unfortunately, I didn't know the first thing about making an album. The other people in the band had more experience than me, and I sort of let other people's vision take over the process. And not my good friend the bass player, it was other people in the band. But we ended up with an album that I don't think anybody was happy with. Nobody in the band, not the label that was paying to press it, definitely not the couple of places that actually reviewed the record. And I don't know the final numbers, but I would be surprised if we sold any copies at all. I don't even have a copy of it anymore. You can't stream it. I do have it on an old iPod somewhere, but that's it. I looked it up just for this episode, and you can buy the CD online for like $3. According to Discogs, someone bought one in 2019. I don't know why. That band changed some members around. We kept on going for a few years, and I had a great time. We played a lot of fun shows. I got to play at Gilman Street, which was one of my dreams. We met a lot of great people. And then it just sort of fell apart. We had written songs for a second album, and I had dreamed that that was going to be our redemption. But we never recorded it. We were one and done. I'm not sad about this or anything. This set me on the path to go back to school and get to where my life is now, so I don't really have any regrets. But I do feel a special kinship for artists that only released one album. I always wonder what their stories are. A lot of times it's because the band's time was cut short by tragedy. Some of my favorites are Jeff Buckley or The Exploding Hearts. But other times the story is something more complicated. On today's episode, I have three of the complicated kind of stories for you. The first story is about a band who formed because of a prophecy. And even though many consider their music to be some of the worst ever recorded, in their own way, they fulfilled that prophecy. The second story is about an obsessive perfectionist who was so disappointed with his band's first album that he never made another one. And the third story is about a singer-songwriter who released only one album as an artist, but as a songwriter had a long and strange career that brought about some massive hits that you'd never believe were written by the same person. These are three stories of one album wonders. I'm Patrick Hicks, and this is Good Measure.
What keeps us together across time, across space? The fragile moments that could as well be lost, but we hold on.
Fremont is a small town in New Hampshire of only a couple thousand people. There's not much to do there, or at least there wasn't in the 1950s and 60s. For fun, people would go to square dances or race snowmobiles on a farm. People there talk with a thick New England accent. Most people were blue collar. They were farmers or workers at the nearby textile mill. Austin Wiggin Jr. was a Fremont resident and a mill worker, but his mother was something a little more exciting. His mother was a fortune teller, and when Austin was young, she made a prophecy for him. There were three parts to the prophecy. The first part was that he would marry a woman with strawberry blonde hair. The second was that he and his wife would have two sons, but Austin's mother would die before they were born. And the third part of the prophecy was that he would also have daughters, and his daughters would grow up to be in a popular music group. So when Austin grew up, he did indeed meet and marry a woman named Anne, who had strawberry blonde hair. And after Austin's mother passed away, he and Anne had two sons. So the first two parts of his mother's prophecy had come true. And then he had daughters. Dorothy Dot Wiggin, Betty Wiggin, and Helen Wiggin. Naturally, since the first two parts of the prophecy had come true, Austin became convinced that his girls were destined to be a famous rock and roll band. Austin was very different from the average stage dad. He had no interest at all in music himself. Neither did the girl's mother, Anne. She liked TV more than music. Austin didn't want any fame or recognition for himself. People described him as an ornery loner. If it was not for this prophecy, the Wiggin girls said, there's no way he would have cared about them being in a band. But because there was this prophecy, he forced them to be in a band. In 1965, when the girls were teenagers, he took them out of public school, started homeschooling them, and had them focus on being a band. He bought them some cheap instruments. Dot and Betty got guitars, and Helen got drums. There was no bass for a long time, but there was another Wiggin daughter, Rachel, who would eventually play bass sometimes. But the classic lineup, as it were, was a bassless power trio.
We had graduated from grammar school, eighth grade. And then he started buying guitars and giving us voice lessons and guitar lessons. And well, I think it was a prophecy that my father got from his mother. Well, he said his mother read the palm of his hand, said he was going to marry a strawberry blonde and have three daughters that were going to be in a band. He did marry. My mom was a strawberry blonde. And there's four daughters, but only three ended up being in the band because Rachel was 6 years younger than I am. So yeah, that's where it all started.
The girls had no interest in being in a band. They did like music. They were fans of Herman's Hermits and popular teen idols like Ricky Nelson, but they hadn't wanted to be in a band. They had no desire to learn how to play instruments. And they never really did. They didn't know how to tune their instruments. They didn't know anything about rhythm or tempo or time or song structure, but they made music anyway. Austin named the band after a popular haircut of the day, the Shags. The Shags played their first show in public at a talent show in the nearby town of Exeter, New Hampshire in 1968. The audience threw soda cans at them. The girls hadn't wanted to play in the first place. They didn't think they were ready to perform in public, and after the show, their dad's answer was to just make them practice more. He lined up a regular gig for them in Fremont, playing a dance every Saturday night at the Fremont Town Hall. The girls practiced every Monday through Friday after their dad got home from work, then they played at the Town Hall on Saturday, then they practiced again on Sundays. The girls said that playing the dances was fun, even though people made fun of them and threw garbage at them, but sometimes people danced too, and they liked that part. And they liked writing the lyrics to their songs. They wrote about the topics that they understood as homeschooled teenage girls. They wrote about their parents, their cat, Halloween. They liked writing the lyrics, but they hated all of the practicing. They didn't want to be in a band, but they didn't want to upset their father, and they didn't want to be disrespectful to their late grandmother, Their dad would sometimes hold seances to try to speak with her from beyond the grave. During one of these seances, the girls say Helen actually passed out, so they stopped doing them. The band had one song in particular that Austin insisted they practice over and over. It was a song called Philosophy of the World. For whatever reason, Austin was never happy with their performance of that song. But that song did become the title track of their album.
I don't even know where I got that title from. Yeah, it just started with the time. My hair has always been wavy. And then in the winter or a lot of wet weather, it gets curly, but also frizzy. And I always wanted straight hair. So that's where that part came from. And I don't even know where I got the name Philosophy to name it that. I don't even know. The lyrics just came to my head. I don't know. I guess they came from God. It's the only thing I can say.
In 1969, Austin became convinced that the girls were ready to record an album. He sold everything that he could, and he brought the girls to record a record at Fleetwood Studios in Revere, Massachusetts, just outside of Boston. Funny enough, a city the girls had never been to, despite being only an hour away. And when the girls started playing, the staff at Fleetwood couldn't believe what they were hearing. Producer Bobby Hearn said that they shut the control room doors and were rolling on the floor laughing. An engineer tried to tell Austin that the girls weren't ready to record an album, but Austin said he wanted to, quote, get them while they're hot. The producers were flabbergasted. It just all sounded like noise, but sometimes the girls would be playing a song and then stop, saying that they'd messed up, and the producers couldn't figure out what they had messed up or how they would possibly know. Here's an example of one of their songs. It's called My Pal Foot Foot. The music does sound strange, but you can hear how much they practiced when you hear those harmonies between Dot and Betty. The girls knew that they weren't making music that sounded like what they heard on the radio. They weren't delusional, but they said that they did their best. They certainly didn't think they were making an album that some would call the worst album ever made. At the time they recorded Philosophy of the World, Dot was 21, Betty was 18, and Helen was 22. An employee of Fleetwood named Charlie Dreyer had a little record label called Third World Records. Austin paid Third World to press 1,000 copies of the album that they would call Philosophy of the World. Apparently, Charlie tried to bring in session musicians to re-record parts of the music for the album, but the session musicians couldn't follow the music. The instruments were out of tune, the songs shifted time signatures, the drums didn't seem to have anything to do with the guitars, songs didn't stick to just one melody, sometimes every line of a song would have a different melody, so the album was pressed as is. Of the 1,000 records pressed, only 100 seemed to have survived. Dot later said that Dreyer ripped her father off, and he absconded with 900 of the records and then stopped returning his calls. But other people have said that Austin did get all of the records, but he refused to distribute them because he thought someone would steal the Shags' music. And some people think that most of the records were just thrown away. The record wasn't covered in the press anywhere, nobody really heard it outside of Fremont, and the girls just went back to their grueling practice schedule and weekly barn dances. Sometimes they'd get to play at a local nursing home, but things mostly stayed the same. That was until one day in 1975. Austin was watching the girls practice as usual. They played that song Philosophy of the World, and for once, he didn't have any objections. He doesn't make them do it again. He seems satisfied with the song. That night, he goes to bed and suffers a massive heart attack. At 47 years old, Austin Wiggin Jr. was dead. And as soon as he died, the Shags were finally able to break up the band that they had never wanted to be in the first place. The sisters all got married, they got regular jobs, Dot became a house cleaner, Betty was a school janitor and then worked in a warehouse, Helen lived on disability due to serious depression. Nobody thought much about the band anymore. The Shags were not trying to get anybody to notice their band. But the world found the Shags. One of the few copies of Philosophy of the World that did exist found its way into the hands of a radio station in Boston called WBCN. They were known for giving their DJs a lot of freedom when it came to choosing what music to play, and they started playing the Shags on the radio. Of course, at first, the intention was to mock them. Just like the girls had been forced to endure at that talent show and their weekly town hall performances. But then, the music got to people who genuinely liked it. The childish innocence and naivete of the playing and the lyrics, some people felt was beautiful. With punk rock taking off, some people viewed the Shags as the ultimate punk band. People joked that bands like the Ramones couldn't play because their songs only had 3 chords. The Shags didn't sound like they knew any chords. The one thing you couldn't say about the Shags is that they were unoriginal. They were the most original band there was. Maybe, as some have said, the only truly original band in the world, because they had such little outside influence. They had no musical heroes that they were trying to emulate. They didn't even want to be playing. They had to figure out how to make music on their own, which some have suggested that the fact that they made anything even resembling music is amazing. Some compared their music to discordant free jazz artists like Ornette Coleman. Frank Zappa gave an interview in 1976 where he said the Shags were one of his favorite bands. A band called NRBQ were such big fans that they actually got Philosophy of the World reissued in 1980. Those original 1969 pressings now sell for thousands of dollars. In reviewing that reissued record in 1980, the infamous critic Lester Bangs wrote, "How do they sound? Perfect. They can't play a lick. But mainly, they got the right attitude, which is all rock and roll's ever been about from day one. They just wang and blang away while singing in harmonies reminiscent of 3 singing nuns who have been sniffing lighter fluid, and their voices are just so copacetic together, being sisters after all, you'd almost think they were Siamese triplets. Guitar style, sort of like 14 pocket combs being run through a moose's dorsal, but very gently. Yet, it rocks. Does it ever." They don't make them like Lester Bangs anymore. The headline of the Bangs piece said that the Shags were better than the Beatles. Sometimes people attribute that quote to Frank Zappa, but it comes from this Lester Bangs review. Rolling Stone gave the 1980 reissue positive reviews, despite saying that the Shags sounded like a lobotomized version of the Trap Family. The band became cult heroes, favorites of people like Jello Biafra of the Dead Kennedys and Kurt Cobain of Nirvana. Kurt Cobain cited them as a favorite a lot, saying that they were definitely the real deal. When he listed his 50 greatest albums of all time, he had Philosophy of the World at number 5. In 1999, the band got another big boost when Susan Orlean wrote an in-depth piece on them for The New Yorker. This was just after she had written The Orchid Thief, the book that would lead to Meryl Streep playing her in the movie adaptation. Orlean's article did a lot to shed light on the sadness of the story. When she interviewed the girls, they told her about how they felt lonely and isolated growing up. Felt like they had missed out on friends because they were forced to be in this band. The article also discusses the abusive nature of the girls' father. While Dot described their father as nice, despite his overbearing ways, and Betty said that any rumors of their father abusing them sexually was untrue, Helen said that her father had been inappropriately intimate with her. Helen was so scared of her father that when she got married at 28 to a boy she had met at one of the Shags' town hall shows, she still lived at home for 3 months after the wedding because she didn't want to tell him. And when she finally did get the courage to tell her dad, Austin got a shotgun. The police intervened, and finally Helen got out of her father's home. After Austin died, Betty and Dot did the same, and their mother Annie sold the family house. According to the new owner, Austin's ghost haunted the house, so the owner built another house on the property and then let the Fremont Fire Department burn the old house to the ground for practice. Due to the rising cult status of the band, they have performed in public again a few times over the years. Dot even had her own band for a while called the Dot Wiggin Band. She still didn't seem to have that much interest in music, but she wanted to try to find a way to make money off this strange legacy. In interviews, Dot's new band members described how hard it was to learn Dot's music, for a lot of the same reasons that those session musicians so long ago struggled.
The hardest thing is to memorize all of the melody. There's so much melody. It's really melismatic and it's really irregular. So every syllable has a different pitch. So when you sing like my pal's name is Footfoot, there's a separate pitch to every word always on every song, like every time. And then the guitar always matches it. So it just seems like there's this pull, and then whether it goes with the drums or not is like completely, there's no like rules.
It's hard to describe the Shag sound. It's not based on rhythm, which is why everyone always thought Helen the drummer didn't know what she was doing. She knew what she was doing. She just wasn't doing what Dot and Betty were doing. It's based on melody, and it follows the melody ruthlessly without regard for rhythm. I don't think Dot hears rhythm. I'm not sure about that, and I'm certainly not insulting her when I say that. I think she hears music in a different way than the rest of us do. I think she really only hears the melody, and the melody goes where it will, and if you're lucky, you follow it.
But they also revealed some surprises, like the fact that Dot actually could read music, and they suggest that maybe the Shags knew what they were doing more than we all thought.
The Shags knew exactly what they were doing. They might not have been able to do it as traditionally as other bands. They might not have been able to keep their guitars in tune or to keep a standard 4/4 beat. But, we have a chart for My Pal Footfoot. It's all there. So she knows exactly what she was doing. And that was scary.
The Shags are sometimes referred to as being in the genre of outsider music. Outsider art was a term that meant art by people who were self-taught and untrained. Often this would be art made by people with mental illnesses. And applying that term to outsider music came around in the 1990s. But the Shags are often held up as an example of this genre. Personally, I have sort of an uneasy relationship with outsider music because I do genuinely love a lot of the music. I love artists like Daniel Johnston and Wesley Willis. I find the simplicity of the music wonderful. But I'm always a little wary of how many people like outsider music because they're mocking it. Are people listening to it the same way you would watch a bad movie like The Room or Sharknado? I find a lot of the reviews of the Shags kind of condescending. Also, writers constantly talk about their appearance. The Wall Street Journal called them dowdy. Even Susan Orlean called them sweet and lumpish. And the debate about the Shags still goes on to this day. Were they bad? Were they so bad that they're good? Or were they just good? No matter what you think, the music that they made, the one full-length album they recorded, made an impact that nobody, except maybe their psychic grandmother, saw coming. Lester Bangs said that the Shags recorded an album up in New England that can stand easily with Beatles 65, which is such an odd Lester Bangs reference, since that's like the US version of the official fourth Beatles album, Beatles for Sale. But it's a good segue to the next story, because it's about a band out of the Beatles' home city of Liverpool. It's about a band who were around for 9 years, then reformed several times, most recently in 2011, have had over 24 members, and who only ever released one full-length album. The band was called The Laws. The name came to Mike Badger in a dream. He liked that the name was a musical reference, but also was the way that they said lads up in Liverpool. Badger said that Liverpool in the 1980s wasn't exactly the same Liverpool that the Beatles had come up in. He said that the city was washed away on a tide of heroin, despondency, and unemployment. But there was still a lot of great music happening there. And Badger started The Laws there in 1983. But in 1984, a new member joined the band who would not just shape the course the band would take, but he would rip it right out of Mike Badger's hands entirely. His name was Lee Mavers. He originally came in as a rhythm guitarist, but soon worked his way to the front of the group and started writing all the songs. The early Laws with Mike Badger on vocals were very post-punk, reminiscent of The Fall.
With her legs to one side, she'd look well on the grass in the wild.
but Mavers brought a unique bundle of influences to the band. When he had first connected with Badger in 1984 at the Everyman Theatre in Liverpool, the two had bonded over a love of Captain Beefheart. Mavers loved a lot of early American rock and roll stars, Bo Diddley, Chuck Berry, a little later James Brown, and then 60s British groups, especially early Who. And when asked about the most famous band from Liverpool, Mavers said, of course, the Beatles influenced everything, but they weren't in his personal top 10. In 1986, Mike Badger met an 18-year-old bassist named John Power at a program for unemployed musicians. Power couldn't even really play that much, but when Mike told him that he had a band, Power jumped at the chance to be in it. He said Mike was tall and really cool. Then he met Lee Mavers, who he said came in looking like a disheveled elf. But Mike and Lee played him a song that Lee had written called Son of a Gun, a song that would eventually be the first song on their debut album. And Power was hooked. Mike Badger said that Lee was a very funny guy, very talented. He said when he played guitar, there's no one like him. But the two began fighting. Lee was seizing control of the band. He didn't care about Mike's contributions. And finally, during one fight in December of 1986, Lee told Mike, "Your time's nearly up in this band." And Mike said, "What? It's not even your band," but said, "Fine, I'm off." He packed his guitar, he got on the bus, and he quit the band that he'd founded. Mike later said he was gutted. 2 years' work gone overnight. After leaving the Laws in 1986, Mike did start a new band called The Onset. And The Onset, funnily enough, also only had one proper album, 1988's The Pool of Life. But with Lee Mavers at the helm, the popularity of The Laws was exploding. A bunch of record labels wanted to sign them, but they ended up signing with this London label called Go Discs. They were the home of artists like Billy Bragg and the House Martins. The Laws released their first single, a song called Way Out, in 1987. The single was produced by Gavin McKillop, who would later move to America and produce for artists like the Goo Goo Dolls, and it was pretty well received. The single broke into the top 100 singles chart in the UK, and it was even praised by the notoriously hard-to-please Morrissey. The Laws were one of the few things that Morrissey and Smith's guitarist Johnny Marr agreed on. Johnny Marr said that Lee Mavers was just as good as everyone thinks he is. In 1988, the band puts out another single, this one produced by Bob Andrews, that is critically well received, but it only goes to number 59 on the singles charts. Their next single was meant to be a song called Timeless Melody, and there were actually test pressings of it made, and it was going to be single of the week in a newspaper, but Mavers was unhappy with the production of the single, and he blocked it from being released. And unfortunately, this would be a sign of things to come. It took the Laws 2 years to record their first album, and the band went through numerous lineup changes and blew through a bunch of different producers. Mavers and the bassist John Power were the only consistent members through this time. First, the band worked with John Porter, who had produced the Smiths' debut album and singles for them like How Soon Is Now, but the band wasn't happy with him. Then they worked with John Leckie, who had produced albums for XTC, Simple Minds, The Fall. He would go on to produce some really big albums in the 90s, probably most notably Radiohead's The Bends. But John Leckie, the Laws weren't happy with him either. Now, it wasn't that Lee Mavers was a diva or an asshole. Most people describe him as personally a nice, funny guy, but he was an insane perfectionist. He had a specific sound in his head that he wanted to capture, and he just couldn't fully articulate it to people. But he knew that what he was hearing in these studio sessions wasn't right. A guitar player named Barry Sutton, who only lasted in the Laws for 1 year from 1988 to 1989, said that Mavers was hyper-focused on the exact phrasing of guitar parts and having strange guitar tunings. Apparently Mavers would do things like tune the band's guitars to the hum of a fridge. Sutton said there was so much pressure that he was relieved when he got fired from the band. One thing Lee did know was that he wanted a very 60s analog type of sound. So it made sense that Go Disc selected for the next producer for the Laws to work with, Mike Hedges. Hedges had produced records for The Cure and Susie and the Banshees, but Go Discs thought that he could be the one because they found out that Hedges had just acquired some vintage equipment, a 1967 mixing console and a 1968 multi-track straight from Abbey Road Studios. Mavers' obsession with 60s sounds reached mythical proportions. There was a rumor that he refused to record on equipment if it didn't literally have dust from the 1960s on it. Despite Mavers' eccentricities, things started off promising. According to Hedges, everyone thought that the album was going to be great, until the last couple days of the session. They had already recorded 35 songs, but then Lee had a falling out with their drummer at the time, Chris Chirac. He kicked Chris out of the band, and he brought in his brother, Neil Mavers, to play drums. And now he wanted to re-record the whole album with another producer. Hedges didn't have any hard feelings. He still thought Lee Mavers was a genius, but he said that he was his own worst enemy. He said his standards were so high that there was no hope of ever reaching them. In December 1989, the band, which now consisted of Lee Mavers, John Power, Neil Mavers, and the guitarist Peter Cammy Camel, went into London's Eden Studios with producer Steve Lillywhite. Steve Lillywhite, like the previous producers, had impressive credentials. He had produced the first three U2 records and albums for The Pogues, The Psychedelic Furs, Peter Gabriel, ton more. But it shouldn't come as a shock, the band wasn't happy with the sessions. Lee Mavers said that Steve Lillywhite didn't understand their sound, and the band just gave up on the sessions and left. But by this time, finally, their record label Go Discs had had enough. They told Steve Lillywhite, just put the album together with whatever you've got so far, and we're going to release it whether Lee Mavers is happy with it or not. And Lee Mavers was definitely not happy with it. The self-titled album The Laws was released October 1st, 1990. In an interview with the NME in October of 1990, the same month that the album was released, Lee Mavers said that he hated it. He said it was all fucked up like a snake with a broken back. When they asked him what's wrong with it, he said, "What's right with it? It's out of tune, out of time, they've ruined good songs, I'm heartbroken, it's a bag of shit." But critics disagreed. The album was a critical success, and it did pretty well commercially too. The biggest song from the album was actually the song that had already been the band's second single in 1988. The album version was just a remix of the single by Lillywhite, but when it was re-released, it went to number 13 on the UK singles charts, and in the US it went to number 49 on the Billboard Hot 100, and number 2 on the alternative charts. Pretty good for what was a pretty strange song. It was a song that had no verses, it was just all choruses and a bridge. It was a song called There She Goes. The album sold okay, not great, but it had a huge influence on other bands. The album was a few years before Britpop, but in many ways it set the stage for it. Noel Gallagher from Oasis was a massive fan, calling the band one of his favorites and saying that There She Goes was the best song of the 90s. He said that Oasis wanted to finish what The Laws had started. For a brief period, The Laws' old drummer Chris Shattuck was even the drummer for Oasis, and then later Noel's band The High Flying Birds. Pearl Jam's Eddie Vedder said that it was a record that helped him out a lot, and Pearl Jam has covered The Law's song Timeless Melody on tour. And then there's There She Goes. That song has been covered by countless other artists, most notably in the US by the Christian rock turned crossover pop band Sixpence None the Richer. Their cover of the song charted even higher than the original, and the song in different variations has been in tons of movies and TV shows. Even if you don't know the band, you've probably heard that song before. But the release of The Laws album was the beginning of the end for the band. In December 1991, Mavers' trusty sidekick, John Power, left the group. He said that basically they'd been playing the same set list since 1986, and he had to move on. But he started a new band and gave a little nod to The Laws. He named his new band after the last word on the last song on The Laws album. The line was, "The change is cast." And John Power named his new band Cast. Cast released a few albums and enjoyed a decent amount of success in the UK as part of the Britpop movement in the 90s. After John left, Lee Mavers couldn't keep the band going much longer, and the band went on a pretty much permanent hiatus in 1992. They've reformed sporadically over the years, they've performed some shows, but they never made another album. There are live recordings and some home demo recordings of songs that would have been on the second album, and they're brilliant, but they'll likely never be properly recorded. Lee Mavers mostly withdrew from the public eye and refused most interviews. The 90s were hard on him as he struggled with heroin addiction. Actually, a lot of people think There She Goes is about heroin, since it has that line pulsing through my veins, but Lee and other band members have confirmed that that isn't true. Lee said he tried heroin for the first time in 1990. Lee became such a recluse that urban legends sprung up over the years about what had happened to him. Everything from he just retired from music to become a painter, or that he was secretly writing hit songs for other artists, or that he was living in a monastery as a monk. But in 2013, Lee granted an interview to a writer named Daniel Rachel for a book called Isle of Noises, Conversations with Great British Songwriters. And in that interview, Lee said that it wasn't anything that intriguing. He had gotten clean off of heroin, he'd become a father of four kids, he was a big fan of the football club Everton, and he was just living a happy, quiet life. Mike Badger, the man that formed the Laws, said that the song There She Goes was a blessing and a curse for Lee. He said it's the best thing that ever happened to him, but also the worst. He wrote this perfect song, but it's meant that he hasn't had to do anything because he has a constant source of income. So it's unlikely that we'll ever get a second album from the Laws. But as Noel Gallagher from Oasis said, if you're only going to make one album, make it that one. Noel also said that whenever he did see Lee Mavers, he would always ask him, "When's the second album coming?" And Lee would always reply, "I'll let you know when I finish the first one." The first two stories in this episode have been about bands whose one and only album was the pinnacle of their short-lived careers. This last story is about an artist whose sole album was only the start. Alta Willis was born in Detroit, Michigan on November 10, 1947. Her name Alta means high or elevated, but everyone called her Allie. When Allie was young, she fell in love with the new music that was becoming synonymous with her city, Motown. She would go to the Motown studio, the converted house at 2648 West Grand Boulevard in Detroit that Berry Gordy called Hitsville, USA, every weekend. She would just sit on the front lawn watching the stars go in and out of the building, soaking up all the music that she could hear coming through the walls. It was on that lawn that Allie said she learned to become a songwriter. She would hear a bass line coming through the wall and be transfixed, but have no idea what it was. Then later she would hear the records come out and recognize them. Oh, that bass line was I Heard It Through the Grapevine. She never learned to play music in her whole career. She wrote her songs to rhythms. Allie's Jewish parents weren't thrilled with all the time she spent at Motown and her obsession with this music. When Allie went off to college at the University of Wisconsin to study journalism, her father wrote her a note that said, "Stay away from black culture." As an adult, Allie would have that note framed and hung in her house. Going to college in the 1960s, she became an active supporter of the civil rights movement. She said she started college as a sorority girl and ended up marching and demonstrating. Allie graduated college in 1969 and moved to New York City. She got a job working as a secretary at Columbia Records and soon was promoted to the advertising department. She got to write copy and liner notes for artists that she loved, like Aretha Franklin, Barbara Streisand, Laura Nyro, Janis Joplin, and she also started writing songs of her own. She was inspired, funnily enough, if you listen to the last episode of this podcast, by the artist Gilbert O'Sullivan. When his song Alone Again Naturally came out, she was a huge fan and she wrote her own lyrics to his song. Then she called up a friend who had a piano and he came over and they started writing songs together. She continued her method of writing songs to rhythms. She said she could write a song to anything, to a teaspoon dropping on a counter. She would sometimes write music too, and it would bother her that people thought she was just a lyricist, but she said that she prided herself on her lyrics. She said she was a stickler on them being really intelligent, not being typical song lyrics. So she wrote this batch of songs, and she took them to her boss at Columbia Records. He liked them, so then they had to go to his boss. and he liked them, and ultimately it went all the way up to Clive Davis, who was the head of Columbia. He actually had no idea that Allie worked for them in the advertising department, and he gave her a record deal for one album. Then she had to quit her job because of the conflict of interest. Allie's one and only album, called Child Star, was released in 1974.
I have a nose that curves like air and leads the way to my mouth that chews my thoughts and talks my talk.
Sales were poor, and she also found that she hated performing. She was terrified of it and didn't want to do it, and Columbia didn't offer her a contract for any more albums. But Child Star did have its fans, one of whom was the singer Bonnie Raitt, another person we've talked about on this podcast before. Bonnie was the first person to record one of Allie's songs, doing a song called Got You On My Mind on her 1974 album Streetlights. Allie relocated to Los Angeles and tried to make it as a songwriter. After the Bonnie Raitt song, she had a song recorded by Patti LaBelle, then Herbie Hancock. But none of these songs were hits, and she wasn't making a living with her songwriting. She had to work odd jobs to support herself, like checking hats in a comedy club, hanging posters for a cabaret. Even after she landed a publishing deal with A&M in 1977, by 1978 she was living on food stamps. And then, through a mutual friend, she met Verdine White, best known as the bassist for the band Earth, Wind & Fire. Verdine introduced her to his half-brother, Earth, Wind & Fire's lead singer Maurice White, and Maurice asked her if she wanted to write with them. In fact, Maurice wanted her to co-write their entire next album, but he said, before we can get started on that project, we have to write one song first. Earth, Wind & Fire had a Greatest Hits album coming out, The Best of Earth, Wind & Fire Volume 1. And for the album, they were doing that trick that so many bands do, throwing in a new original song on the collection to try to drive up sales. They had an idea for the song, but they needed lyrics. So Allie walks into the studio the day after Maurice had called her with the offer, and when she opened the door, the band was playing the intro to a new song. It was based around a four-chord progression that Earth, Wind & Fire guitarist Al McKay had come up with, and Allie said it sounded like the happiest-sounding song in the world. She said, "Dear God, let this be what they want me to write." And it was. For about a month, Maurice White and Allie Willis worked on a song together about chasing clouds away, holding hands, and dancing in the night. The song was called September.
Do you remember?
Allie loved the song, but there was one part that bothered her as they were writing it. Whenever Maurice was doing work vocals, like demos, he had a placeholder lyric that he would use in basically every song. Badia. And when writing September, he put those nonsense words into the chorus. Allie kept saying, "We're gonna change the badia to real words, right?" But it started to become clear that Maurice wasn't gonna change it. When he went in to record the vocals for the song, Allie begged him to rewrite the chorus. She was so exasperated, she said, "What the fuck does badia even mean?" And Maurice White said, "Eh, who the fuck cares?" And Allie said, "I learned my greatest lesson ever in songwriting from him, which was never let the lyric get in the way of the groove." September was Allie's breakthrough. It was released as a single and became a huge hit. Number one in the R&B charts, number eight on the US Hot 100, number three on the UK singles charts. But even more than that, it's a song that has endured throughout the decades. Allie said, "I've literally never been to a wedding, a bar mitzvah, anything where I have not heard that song play." But she said, "The song is doing what it's meant to do." She said, "I'm someone that absolutely loves writing very joyful music. And when people tell her that that song makes them happy," she said, "for me, that's it." She then got to work on Earth, Wind & Fire's ninth album, I Am. She co-wrote the first single off that record, the song Boogie Wonderland. That song, though not as enduring as September, was actually an even bigger hit in its time, went to number 6 on the Billboard Hot 100. Allie had a bunch more of her songs recorded, but she went a few years without having another big hit. She said at one point in the 80s that she thought she'd never have another hit again. She said that the phone had stopped ringing. And then her publisher matched her up to write with a guy named Danny Sembello. Danny's brother Michael had had a big hit with the song Maniac, and they signed him even though he had never really written anything before. And now Allie's thinking, I got matched with this guy who's never written anything before, how could I get any lower? When he came in to write with her, she told him, I only have an hour, and literally put a timer on. They were tasked with writing a song for a movie, but they weren't told a lot about it. In 1 hour, they wrote the song Neutron Dance, which became a big hit for the Pointer Sisters and was included on the Grammy-winning Beverly Hills Cop soundtrack. And it's hard to say. They also wrote the song Stir It Up, which was recorded by Patti LaBelle for the same soundtrack. She had another big hit in the 80s with the song What Have I Done to Deserve This, which was a duet between the Pet Shop Boys and Dusty Springfield. And that went to number 2 on the charts. From hour to hour, I pour the drinks and crush the flowers. What have I done to deserve this? What have I done to deserve this? But by this time, Allie wasn't limiting herself to just music. She was doing all sorts of art. She was making music videos, making furniture, set design. She had an artist alter ego named Bubbles the Artist. She also acted as Bubbles' manager. She did one-woman shows. She was really into the world of kitsch and collecting kitsch things. She would actually appear on an episode of Storage Wars acting as a kitsch expert. And she was also known for throwing legendary parties. And these weren't like music industry debauchery parties. They were like fun parties filled with games. She would spend weeks preparing games and themes and costumes, and then she would invite a wide variety of guests. Just for a couple examples, Joni Mitchell once won a prize for best dress made out of a hefty bag. Allie said that she accessorized it with French fries and ketchup. At another party, Cher won a game of something called Tampax Toss. She was also really into technology. She was an early adopter of the internet. She even had her own thing called Willis World that was like a proto-social network. In 1992, she was the keynote speaker at the first Digital World Conference. In 1997, she spoke at the U.S. House of Representatives on behalf of songwriters regarding artists' rights related to the internet. She also lectured at Harvard. She delivered TED Talks. She had a long-term partner who was a film producer named Prudence Fenton. And she also wrote one more really big hit song that you've probably heard before. In 1994, she was tasked with writing the theme song to a new TV show. Originally, this TV show had wanted to use R.E.M.'s Shiny Happy People, apparently not realizing that the song is a satire. And R.E.M. said no, so they wanted to write their own song that would kind of sound like it and have a bouncy, poppy kind of feel. And they got Allie to write the song along with the husband of the show's producer. Then they had to find a band to record it, and they took it to this band called the Rembrandts, who didn't want to do it, but they were basically the only band signed on Warner Brothers Records. Warner Brothers was producing the show. They were the only band that was available. So the Rembrandts recorded this theme song called I'll Be There For You, and the song became the theme song to the show Friends. No one told you life was gonna be this way. The song was actually so popular that radio stations started looping the theme song and playing it on the radio, so the Rembrandts actually went and recorded an actual full song of it. So yeah, fun fact, if you didn't know, the same woman that wrote September also wrote the theme song to Friends. She also wrote music for the Broadway adaptation of The Color Purple. Apparently the last words that she ever said to her racist dad before he passed away was that she got a job working on The Color Purple. Allie Willis was inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame in 2018. She was the only woman inducted that year, something that she called them out on. She was never afraid to speak out about what it was like being a female songwriter in a male-dominated industry. She complained about how very, very few big female songwriters went on to be producers. which was the logical step you would take, she said. That's where all the money is. Certainly, any male that had even half my credits would have automatically been a producer. That I was always conscious of. Allie passed away in 2019 at the age of 72. In 1974, when Allie Willis's album Child Star flopped, she probably felt like her career was over. But that's why you should never let just one album define you, even if it's the only album you ever make. And one more thought for good measure. There are obviously a ton of bands that only have one album. In fact, I think I might do a spin-off TikTok video about my top 5 one-album wonders. But then I was thinking about musicians who were in different bands where both bands only had one album. And then I thought of 2 musicians who actually were in 3 different bands that only had one album. And it's kind of funny because one of them I just talked about in the One More Thought for Good Measure on the first episode of this season. But that's Stone Gossard. So Stone Gossard and Jeff Ament were in the band Green River. It was one of the very first grunge bands in 1984. It featured the lead singer Mark Arm, who went on to be the singer for Mudhoney. And that band only put out 1 full-length album, 1988's Rehab Doll. And then the band broke up. Apparently one of the big fights was that Stone and Jeff wanted to go after a major label deal, and Mark wanted to stay independent. So in 1988, Jeff and Stone start a new band with a guy named Andrew Wood called Mother Love Bone. And this band is poised to blow up. They do sign with a major label, Mercury, and their full-length album, Apple, comes out July 19th, 1990. Unfortunately, in March of 1990, lead singer Andrew Wood died of a heroin overdose. So the band broke up, and Stone and Jeff are looking for another band again. But while they're putting together their next band, Andrew Wood's old roommate, Chris Cornell from the band Soundgarden, asks Stone and Jeff if they want to get together and make a tribute record to Andrew. So they form the band Temple of the Dog. Their one and only album was released in 1991, and it featured the guy who Jeff and Stone had brought in to be the singer of their new band, Eddie Vedder. He had sent in a tape to Jeff and Stone where he recorded his vocals over their instrumentals, and they loved it, but they brought him up to Seattle to see if he would fit to join their band, and apparently he was there watching Temple of the Dog practice. And when Temple of the Dog was working on the song Hunger Strike, Eddie Vedder, who was just watching, got up and started singing along with Chris Cornell. Chris Cornell loved the way it sounded and made the song a duet. So that was 3 one-and-done albums in a row. Green River, Mother Love Bone, Temple of the Dog. Then, with Eddie Vedder, they started the band Pearl Jam, and they broke the one-album curse.
Some words said in passing, the entire world crashing down. That it's over, but then it goes on and on and on.
This episode of Good Measure was written, edited, produced by me, Patrick Hicks. Thank you, as always, to Brian Ashiba and the band Joy Weather for doing the theme song to this podcast. If you enjoy this podcast, please go rate and leave a review on wherever you listen to this. And consider supporting me on Patreon. It's patreon.com/PatrickHicksMusicStories. And thank you, of course, to my wife. Happy anniversary this week.